Roger Waters, chief architect of The Wall, is in the middle of a revival tour of that show. He's playing to rave reviews. There's also a new book out called The Making of Pink Floyd, The Wall, by artist Gerald Scarf. He is world-renowned as a political cartoonist, illustrator, designer, filmmaker, and his place in all things Floyd is more than secured by, among other projects with the band, his work on The Wall. So we're very glad to welcome Gerald Scarf to the show. Thanks for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure.
I should tell you, in case you don't already know, that your handwriting is, among anyone's in the world, the most instantly recognizable among Pink Floyd fans.
Yeah, I've written over everything. I think I've written all over the wall now. And also, when Roger was advertising this particular concert, he had my handwriting projected onto buildings.
Yes.
There's a saying by Eisenhower about every gun that's built, you know, robs from the poor, robs from the needy. And so I wrote that in my writing, and it was projected all over New York, Los Angeles, and various other cities. So I'm scribbling all over America now, too.
We're going to get to The Wall in just a minute, but I thought it might make sense to start at the beginning with Pink Floyd. When did you first get involved with the band? It was before The Wall.
It was way before The Wall, yes. I think it was during Wish You Were Here, and the guys saw some work that I'd done in animation for the BBC. I went to Los Angeles, and I did a small film, an animated film myself, lasting about 20 minutes, in which I did everything American I could think of at that time, which was, you know, John Wayne, Frank Sinatra, Statue of Liberty, Playboy magazine, Walt Disney, Mickey Mouse, you know, ice cream sodas, all the things that I thought were America. And I had them all flowing one into another, morphing into one and another. And apparently the guys saw this on TV here in Britain, and Roger said to Nick, you know, we've got to have this guy on board. He's mad. So that's how I got introduced to the group. And thereafter, I just did small bits of animation for them, which I took almost daily to their gigs. I do a little bit of animation, and on more likely weekly, I guess. And they just kind of jam it in wherever it seemed to work. And by serendipity, sometimes it seemed to sort of flow with the music. And but as Nick told me, you know, the eye will make an association, and the eye and the ear will make an association between sound and vision. You know, if you put two together, you can kind of make them work. So that's how it all began.
When you first got the call from the band, had you heard of Pink Floyd? What was your impression of the band before you met them?
Yeah, of course, I had heard of Pink Floyd, but I can't say I was a Pink Floyd fan, or I can't say I was not a Pink Floyd fan. I just heard of them, you know. And when they contacted me, I went to meet them here in London, all four of them, in a room in, I think it was in Nick's house in Kentish Town, an area of London here. And I went, I don't know what I was going to meet, you know, these. But they were all surprisingly civilized. I don't know what I expected, really. But and they're very sensible and very kind of straightforward.
Yeah.
And you know, so I was happily surprised. They asked me to do some animation immediately, and I said, well, okay. But I didn't do anything about it. I didn't know how to handle it or what to do. And they then took me to see Dark Side of the Moon, and I was so impressed by the theatricality of that on stage. You know, there's this stuka that comes from the back of a theater and crashes on stage, just as it does in The Wall. And the theatricality of it, you know, really, really got me. And I thought, oh, these guys are good, because I can illustrate a lot of stuff here. And they wanted me. I mean, Nick very kindly says in the book, you know, that to employ me at that point was a step up for them too, because mm-hmm. they just started to make big money with Dark Side and the Moon, and they, you know, they wanted a kind of name artist on board, and that was me. And then Roger finally came to me many years later and said, I've just written this thing, The Wall. I knew he was doing that. And he wanted to play me these raw tapes that he'd sung to a synthesizer, and he put it all on tape. And he came to my studio in Chelsea here in London and played them to me. And it was a kind of an awkward moment when he finished, because what do you say when someone just, you know, plays their whole life out to you? And I didn't have anything adequate to say. You know, I said, oh, well, yeah, well, that's great, you know. And then there was a kind of an awkward silence. And Roger says, you know, I feel as though I pulled my pants down in front of you, because I feel so vulnerable, you know, having poured everything out to this one guy who was me. Anyway, then Roger decided at that point that we should make an album of it. He would make an album of it, and then a concert.
So you knew at the beginning that this would be more than just an album. This would be a concert.
Well, that was the plan. We didn't know how much we'd pull off. And we wanted to get as far as the movie, which we finally did. But it was at that point that he planned it. And so we worked together for, you know, many, many months, a year, I guess. And we play a lot of snooker together, which is kind of like an English pool game, and we drank a lot of beer together, and we you know, conceived the wall. He did the lyrics and music, of course, which is the important part, and the vision is mine, my interpretation of his ideas.
I'm wondering where you got the inspiration for the characters. You've done a lot of political cartooning in which you're characterizing, you know, actual living people, but with The Wall, where did you come up with, you know, the teacher and the judge and just from the music itself?
Really, no. I guess it's out of my imagination, because the teacher is a teacher, you know, and I thought that I wanted to make the teacher very symbolic, not too much like a real character, because real characters don't have the longevity. They don't last as long. And I wanted something that would, you know, stick in the memory, a kind of weird teacher that, and quite a sort of simplistic one. And also I had to eventually make inflatables. And they had to be, therefore, pretty simplistic. And so I think, I of course, it's impossible for an artist to know where, you know, it all truly comes from. But it has become apparent to me. I've written this book now about the making of The Wall and the putting together of The Wall. It's kind of like a history of how the whole thing was conceived and brought to fruition. And I realized when I was putting that together that, in actual fact, you know, the vision that you see is not Roger's, it's mine. Mm. But it's my interpretation of what I thought Roger's life was like.
So Roger didn't have any really direct influence on your art. He sort of took what you gave him?
Yes, he's very open like that. He said, you know, if I have the philosophy that if I hire an artist, I hire him for what he does. I'm not about to try and change it, you know, that would be ridiculous. And so when it came to something like the forces of oppression that we were trying to do, I designed the hammers. They just came into my head one day as the most unrelenting, cruel piece of machinery, a vicious hammer. And that, you know, wasn't Roger's idea. It was his germ of the idea, but he didn't think of them as hammers. But he was very supportive, and as soon as he saw something like the hammers, he would say, that's it, we got it, you know. And then I think in the instance of the hammers, he actually wrote hammer, hammer, hammer into the lyrics. So it was a slightly two-way process, not very much, you know. Mainly Roger was leading, and I was just illustrating, really, everything that I thought he would see.
The hammers have become such an icon of The Wall as well, especially when they're marching across in fields of, you know, thousands and thousands. You mentioned your book. I read the book last week and enjoyed it thoroughly.
Thank you.
One of the things that struck me, and one of the things I think is the best part of the book, is like you said, it's the entire history. You see sort of the earlier works and how they morphed into becoming, you know, the art that Floyd fans know instantly. It seemed to me that some of the earlier drafts, not all of them, but were a little more graphic. I mean, there's an illustration in the book of bodies hanging from nooses along the stage. There's one of the teacher vomiting into the mouths of students. And I wondered if there was any sort of a conscious decision to tone things down as you got closer to the end, or is that just a coincidence?
Not at all. I don't think there was any conscious decision of that type at all. I think that it just, you know, I mean, there are some pretty vicious images in the movie, and there are skulls being crushed and people being executed, all sorts of things going on there, and very sexually explicit flowers, you know. And so I don't think it was any, if anything, you know, I think, especially when we got to the movie, because of the kind of differences between us all, it pushed us into excess. And there was a lot of angst and fighting, infighting over the movie.
Somewhat legendary, I should say.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's understandable. Looking back now, I can see that when Alan Parker came in, he, as a movie director, wanted to take the movie and direct it. Roger and I, who'd already invested 3 years of our lives in putting it together, weren't about to let that happen. You know, we weren't going to relinquish our power. So that's what it was, as Alan himself said, you know, you put three megalomaniacs in a room together, what do you expect? You're going to get trouble. But I think a lot of that, you know, paid off in the film in a way. And as you can see in the book, Alan came to my studio here in London and we talked over, you know, these times, and I'm glad to say 30 years later, it doesn't mean a damn thing.
Yeah, right.
It is one of the good things about, you know, to feel philosophic about if you have any really, really bad moments. Yeah. With the passage of time, you know, hopefully it won't be so painful.
I saw a quote from Sir Alan actually just last week. He was speaking at an event or something, and I will probably paraphrase it, but he said something about along the lines of that was the most miserable experience of his career. It's what he is.
It was. I think it was. It was. I mean, you know, the early bit with me and Roger when we were just doing the album and the show, that was fine. But when Alan came in and naturally, as I say, wanted to direct it, then I found myself driving to Pinewood Studios, which is where we finished the movie here, which is that's where they make the James Bond films here, Pinewood. I would find myself at about 9 o'clock in the morning driving in my car with a bottle of Jack Daniels on the passenger seat. I'm not a heavy drinker, but I had to have a slug before I went in the morning, just because I knew what was coming up, you know, and I knew I had to fortify myself in some way.
We're talking with Gerald Scarfe from his London home via Skype. He is the man responsible for the artwork and animations that appeared on and in Pink Floyd's The Wall album, stage show, and 1982 feature film. His new book is The Making of Pink Floyd, The Wall. We have a copy to give away. If you'd like to enter the drawing, just head over to FloydianSlip.com and register to win. Another track from The Wall, followed by more with Gerald Scarfe in just a moment. Our special guest this week, Wall artist and animator Gerald Scarfe. You're a cartoonist for the London Sunday Times and the New Yorker. You've done that now for a very long time. That sort of stuff has a very short shelf life. You do it, and the next issue takes its place before too long. Unlike The Wall, we're looking at 30 years now. These characters are still around, and you're still working with them. I wonder if that's a blessing or a curse. What's that like?
It's great, yeah, because as you say, most of my work in newspapers, like all news, is fleeting. It's topical. It's here today, gone tomorrow. And, you know, one time I'm drawing Nixon, and another time I'm drawing Bush. And they all pass on and go, you know, into the wherever they go. And so then people lose their interest in them. I mean, there are historians and people like that who are very interested in the past, you know, in the recording of historical things graphically. But with The Wall, you're right. I mean, these creatures are still around, and I still meet people who, you know, say to me, "Wow, you worked on The Wall?" And I say, "Yeah." And that's fantastic. Did it change your life? You know, and I say, No, it was just like a job, you know, whoa, it sure changed mine. And so I think there are people out there, it struck a nerve, you know,
sure.
Struck some sort of nerve. And I don't know what that nerve was. I wasn't aware of what we were doing, and I'm not sure Roger was. But I'm very pleased, yes, to have a cult movie with my name on it. And when I went to see the show in Madison Square Garden, I still get the same rush, you know, from seeing my work up there and the fans enjoying it.
Yeah.
You know, it's entertainment on a gigantic Roman Colosseum spectacle style. And it's a show that everybody should see. I mean, even if you're not a Floyd fan, I've heard people saying, you should see this show because it's like a gigantic piece of theater. You can't fail to be not affected by it.
I saw the show in Montreal actually just 2 days ago, and I was not in the good seats. I was very far back, but even from that distance, the inflatables looked huge. I can only imagine up close, you know, what they look
like. They are gigantic. They are huge, huge things.
I would think in some ways that when you're dealing with these characters so far along from when you actually created them, in some ways, is it like looking at old photographs of yourself? I mean, I've always imagined that it must be like, oh, my, I can't believe I did that. Was that really
yes.
me kind of thing?
Yes, I mean, there is that aspect of it. In this particular instance, Roger and I worked on the new edition of the show, and I've added lots of graffiti. And another thing I did was to redesign the inflatables to make them a little bit more sophisticated in as much as they move better. You know, the heads can swivel and the arms can move. And
so those are new inflatables that we're seeing on this tour. They weren't.
They are the others, I guess. Yeah. They are, I guess the others have perished, and you know, being of a kind of that type of material. I think there's one of the teacher in the Museum of Rock in Cleveland. I've seen pictures of that. But no, they're new ones. And but your question, you know, does it weird looking back? Yes, it was. And when I wrote this book, it had a very kind of strange effect, really, going back over all that period of time. And also, I had a weird feeling that I was almost snitching on my pals. You know, I mean, telling stories about the guys. And I thought, how am I going to handle this? And I wrote everything I could down of memories, and some of the memories are not very nice because the band was splitting up at the time, and as I say, Alan Parker and I were not the best of friends at that time. And so, you know, the best thing I thought is I'll write it down and see how I feel about it when I've written it. So some of it I took out, some of the more unpleasant, you know, bits. But in general, it's a pretty accurate account of what happened backstage, what happened in the building of this, the wall. And I've been with the group, you know, almost nearly 40 years, I guess, now I've known them. And they're all still good pals. I had dinner with Nick day before yesterday. And I'm seeing David after the weekend. And I was with Roger in New York, you know, just a couple of weeks ago. So I see them all the time. We're in touch. And, of course, to me, they're ordinary guys. I was in the restaurant with Roger in New York, you know, and some guy came up to me and he said, wow, he said, is that Roger Waters? And I said, yeah. He said, oh, it's not every day you see a rock god, is it? And I thought, that's not a rock god, that's Rog. That's my old pal, Rog. But of course, to millions of people, he's an idol.
Sure. Well, when you first started, when you first got involved with the band, I'm guessing that there was any sort of culture shock moving from the world of being a guy who just sat at a desk and drew cartoons and sketches and moving into the world of rock and roll?
Well, I've always been what my wife calls a kind of showbiz artist. I like my work to be seen, and I used to make films for the BBC, live action films, in which I appeared. I wrote them and appeared in them. I've always designed for the theater, opera, and ballet, and West End theater plays, and so on, musicals, ice shows. I've designed a lot of stuff, so. I do remember Roger saying, you know, you're a rock and roll artist now, you know, and I said, well, I'm not really, I'm not, you know, out there with 20,000 people baying for me, but it was great in, you know, when the flowers come on or something and they all stand up and they all, woo-hoo, that's as nearest I'll get to being Roger or nearest I'll get to being Tom Cruise or whatever it is.
So you didn't really experience much rock and roll debauchery, so to speak.
Well, no, I'm not a druggie. I mean, I think a lot of people, when I first did this stuff, said, hey, man, what do you on? You know, well, I'm not. I'm on alcohol, I guess, but not on anything particularly hard or anything. Of course, there are drugs backstage, and, you know, one has the occasional bit of something or other, but I was an asthmatic as a child, and I think, you know, drugs to me mean something to do with the medical profession. I was so sickly. I was continually being given drugs, and so they don't have the same romantic allure that they might have to some people. But, backstage. In actual fact, the Floyd, I think, were a fairly kind of low-profile rock group. They were not your average rock band, and even the way they came on stage, you know, they would just suddenly be there. They wouldn't come on to huge, you know, firecrackers and that stuff. So, and they, you know, they're just sort of, as I say, as friends of mine, they're kind of straightforward, very, you know, now extremely rich, of course, English middle class people.
Well, I think I've read that Roger used to tour, probably still does, with his golf clubs.
Yes, he loves his golf. He loves his golf, and still plays snooker. And you know, I used to ski a lot with Roger, and he's very, very precise about everything he does. He's very, very in control, you know. Mm. I'm a skier who's kind of what they call intermediate, and sometimes I'm okay. A lot of the time I'm all over the place. But with Roger, he's always okay. He's always controlled. And I think it's that control that's, you know, brought him to such perfection in his work.
I've talked to a couple of different people who have worked with Roger, and one of them described him as a very hard taskmaster, was his phrase.
Yeah, he doesn't suffer fools gladly. You know, if someone screws up, then, you know, he gets upset about it because he thinks, you know, people should do their jobs properly. And that doesn't mean to say, you know, he doesn't, you know, he's... a lot of people call him, you know, hard and so forth, but he's got another side to him when you kind of know him, of course.
How long did it take you to put this book together?
It took me about, about 6 months, because I had to go and find all these drawings that haven't been used, and drawings that were inspirations but never came through. Then, you know, I went back through old diaries, but as Nick Mason said, you know, you're no Dr. Johnson, because my diaries are very, very sparse and spare. And at most it says, Roger, 12 o'clock, snooker, you know, like, and those are my entries in my diaries. But I was able to piece together things backwards, almost like putting a jigsaw together, which was fascinating, you know, because you suddenly remember, I suddenly realized, you know, oh, that wasn't 1982, that was 1986, you know, and, you know, things your memory does to you until you actually lay out the timeline are quite weird. And then I was very, very lucky to get all of the guys to, you know, support me and give interviews for the book, and I showed each of them one by one all the pictures I was putting in, and we went through it and discussed it, and Roger was particularly helpful, of course, because he was, you know, in the inner circle. Dave was always more interested in music, I think. And as he says, he was happy for the visuals and the theatricals to be there, but he, you know, he felt Roger did that better than he did, so he was happy to concentrate on the music. Nick was always had a huge input into it. Rick was a very quiet guy, and I liked him, but he was sort of shy or something, and I can't remember him really saying much about the visuals, but I think that was just more shyness than lack of interest. The book, it's the authentic, you know, they've all backed it. And
getting them all to come together and to support any one thing is sort of difficult these days, I guess.
Very difficult, because they all, like, you know, all groups, they all live independent lives. They don't live with one another or near one another even. And I was impressed to get them all together again after 30 years.
We're speaking with Wall artist Gerald Scarf on Skype on Floydian Slip, show number 761. His new book is The Making of Pink Floyd, The Wall, in bookstores now. Some music, and then more with Gerald Scarf after this. Special guest on this week's program, for only the third time in our 20-year history, we're speaking with a guest on this week's Floydian Slip, Wall artist Gerald Scarf. You mentioned that you had to rework the inflatables for this current tour that Roger is on. Were there other animation changes that you had to make as well for this tour?
Well, yes, because the animation didn't fit the wall. The wall is now huge.
The wall has gotten bigger.
It's got big. And originally, the animation was done for what they call Academy size, which is the normal cinema screen shape. And originally, when we came to do the concert, I had to put three projectors side by side to project the hammers marching. It was actually three images thrown by three projectors. Mm. of the so, but they were all side by side. On this occasion, I think Roger wanted it to be way across, right across the wall, no joins, nothing. And although I think we now have probably 7 projectors, it is one image of the hammers marching across the whole wall, rank upon rank upon rank of them. So a lot of the work that was done, and I wasn't particularly involved in that, but I knew exactly what was happening, but was just to adapt my animation to a new format. And a lot of that is done on the computer, of course.
Right, right. So how so when you did the original animation, you weren't using computers at all. This was all done by hand.
All done in the old Walt Disney style, you know, drawing. And there are 12 drawings every second that flash before your eyes. And in some very, very slow animation, like, well, the flowers, for instance, I think there are 24 drawings every second there, which gives that very, very slow movement as they grow up and develop and copulate. And it's all done in a very, very... And each of those drawings probably would have taken maybe 2 days. So it's incredibly labor-intensive and very expensive. And
how large was your team on that? You did not draw every single.
Oh God, no! I couldn't possibly do that. No, I mean I would still be drawing now. Yeah. The team at one point was 40 people, I guess, and then you know at certain times I would reduce it down to say maybe 15, and then at the end I think there was just like 10 or 12 of us doing the final bits and pieces. It depends on as the volume of work decreased and we were just sort of polishing it, then when we drop people. But it is a very, very tiresome. I'm an impulsive artist, and when I make my drawings for newspapers, of course, being against a deadline, they have to be done quickly. And but when it comes to animation, I always say, if you shout action in January, you don't say cut until December or something.
Well, I say this as a compliment, but your work has given me nightmares.
Well, it gives me nightmares too. But this is my way of getting my nightmares out on paper.
The book is The Making of Pink Floyd, The Wall by Gerald Scarfe. It's $29.95 in bookstores everywhere. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been great to talk to you.
It's been good to talk to you. Okay, bye everybody.